Welcome to Risk Matters, your go-to podcast for mastering operational risk management and preventing industrial incidents in high-hazard industries. I'm George Pilko, founder and chairman of Pilko & Associates, and I'm delighted to invite you to join Risk Matters host, Jean Johns, as she and her expert guests explore the strategies, stories, and solutions that define organizations successfully navigating the challenges of operating in high-hazard industries. Jean Johns has extensive executive experience leading high-hazard businesses across all segments of the energy industry, along with petrochemicals, fertilizers, and explosives. Her safety and operating expertise was called upon by BP in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon tragedy, leading to the transformation of BP's global downstream businesses. This podcast series is a must for any leader in a high-hazard industry. Whether you are faced with a turnaround situation or simply want to take your organization to the next level of operational excellence, these shared real-world leadership experiences will provide you the insights you need to reach your goals. Ready to transform challenges into opportunities? Let's dive in.
Welcome to our very first Safety and Operating Risk podcast, where we discuss our experiences in leading inherently high-hazard industries and share our lessons learned, all in our commitment to eliminate industrial accidents and keep people safe. On today's podcast, we will explore the recovery process inside a company after a tragic industrial event, its challenges and its lessons, and what it means today as we reflect upon it as we further our journey to zero accidents. So with that, it is my great pleasure to introduce our guest today, Steve Cornell. I first met Steve at BP, where he was recruited to lead BP's refining industry in the aftermath of the tragic 2005 Texas City explosion, where 15 people lost their lives. We'll be diving into that later in a bit more detail, but it's worth reflecting on Steve's extensive technical and operating career before BP, which is why BP recruited him for such an important transformational role. Steve's a chemical engineer whose career went through the downstream segment in the energy industry, beginning with operational roles in ExxonMobil and then Total. He has run both refineries and chemical plants, and was the global vice president of petrochemical manufacturing with Total, and later assumed executive roles with Total, responsible for a variety of joint venture and wholly owned organizations across Asia. Steve left Total in 2008 and spent 6 years with BP, with much of that time focused on safety and operational improvements throughout the U.S. refining system. After BP, Steve left and joined the South African flagship energy company, Sasol, and became its co-CEO in 2014. And so with that, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to Steve.
Thank you, Jean. Nice to be here and nice to be able to talk with you again.
Very good. Well, Steve, when I reflect on the tragic Texas City accident, it was such a seminal event in the industry's reckoning with managing both operating risk and ensuring a strong process safety focus. So that makes me wonder, like, why you chose to take on this challenge of transforming BP's safety culture and operating norms in the aftermath of such a tragedy.
Jean, there were days when I wondered that myself. As you said, the explosion at Texas City was such a tragedy. 15 deaths, over 150 injuries. It was a real turning point for the downstream part of the energy industry. When it occurred, I was with Total living in South Korea, and it made headlines over there. Now, I followed the information, you know, that was available, and I got really interested in how a global giant like BP was going to address what, from a distance, appeared to be some pretty fundamental problems in the company. And then almost 2 years after the incident, the report came out from the Independent Safety Review Panel, I think they called it. The Baker Report was issued on the U.S. BP refining system, and that shed a lot of light on what had happened and how difficult it is to manage risk, especially process risk like
what you find in refining activities and petrochemical activities. So, you know, that report detailed the work that was going to be required at BP and across the industry as a result of what happened. I guess I would say that BP wasn't, I'm sure, the only company at the time. There were shortcomings in this area, but I think they probably had a number of factors which aggravated their situation. So when I was approached about taking the role to lead the transformation effort at BP, I thought this is just too important and too interesting to pass. So I took the plunge.
Yeah, I think, Steve, most of us remember where we were on that day of the Texas City accident. You know, I actually remember being on vacation and my executive assistant, you know, called me up and, you know, apologized for interrupting it, but said, you know, I'm not sure why I'm telling you this, but I just know that you'd want to know, which was correct. And like other times when you get this kind of news, you know, you just sort of get shocked first and then disbelief and so on as you just try and digest and make sense of it all. So it was a couple years later after the accident when you joined BP. And so, you know, kind of as you walk through the door and you with your fresh eyes and thinking about your first impressions of BP, what did you find? What did you see as the current reality of the BP U.S. refining system at that time?
Well, first, I was pleasantly surprised at the technical capabilities at BP. I wasn't sure if maybe that could have been the problem, just lack of technical expertise, but there was no lack of know-how or experience. It was clearly not the lack of smart people that led to what happened. BP had a lot of smart people. I'm sure they still have a lot of smart people. That wasn't the problem. Pretty quickly, I came to agree with the conclusions that pretty much were in the Baker panel report, which said a lot of it came down to BP lacking sufficient focus specifically on process safety, which is different from personal safety, as we all know. Personal safety received orders of magnitude more attention in BP than process safety. And what I saw at the beginning was a company at a very immature stage in implementing a common approach to controlling process safety risks like a vapor cloud explosion, which is what happened at Texas City. And so, you know, like I said before, BP wasn't the only company that had shortcomings in regard to managing operational risk, but I think I saw two things that made BP more likely to have the kind of incident that occurred. The first was they had gone through a series of major acquisitions in the prior decade, but there was still, when I came in, absolutely no common operating management system. The BP operating management system, a BP operating system, didn't exist. It relied on whatever was in place at the time of the acquisition. So I came in about 10 years after most of the acquisitions, and there was still an Amoco way of working, an ARCO way of working, and it was really confusing and, to some extent, almost unmanageable. So that was one thing. And the second thing I saw was that the culture within BP seemed to place value in a lot of ways on just the wrong things. That's where I saw, that's where I started, and we went from there.
Absolutely. You know, this personal safety focus is something that really resonated with me because it struck me firsthand a couple of years before the Texas City accident. You know, at the time, I was the corporate HSE lead for BP Chemicals in London. And I remember trying to get approved a new standard about integrity management, which was really about putting the emphasis on process safety for the chemical plants. But there was this overwhelming emphasis on personal safety, whether it was driving safety or holding handrails or even putting lids on coffee cups. It was just so strong that it was next to impossible to get attention on some of the biggest risks that were at the operating plants. You know, ensuring that the equipment and the processes were robust in an integrity management standard was just not a lot of appetite to do that in a consistent way across a company as big as BP.
Yeah, I think that was the misunderstanding was
you can have something that's a very low probability of happening, but the consequence of it can be so severe. You know, that's really different from something that happened all the time, but the consequence of it happening isn't nearly as dramatic as what happened at Texas City.
Absolutely, Steve. You know, and we'll come back a little bit when we get to Macondo about low probability, high impact events. But let's move on to your challenge of fixing the U.S. refining system. You know, as you already noted, you joined BP, you had this Baker Panel report, which was actually a roadmap for how to take the BP's five U.S. refineries to industry leadership position. And one of my strong fundamental management beliefs is the necessity of managing organizations within their capacity to take on change and the amount of work that's put on them. With so much scrutiny that and pressure that you were under to fix it and fix it tomorrow, I mean, how did you go about executing in that environment?
That definitely was one of the biggest challenges in implementing the recommendations. Now, what pieces of the elephant do you tackle first? There were approximately 100 recommendations in the report, which, you know, we needed to address in some fashion, each of them. Then that was further complicated by all the cultural and procedure differences that we talked about, you know, that were present at each of the five refineries. So it was super clear this was going to be a multi-year effort. So to manage it, what we did was establish a very small task force, about four people, reporting directly to me, that had the accountability to put a system in place where we could track on a rather detailed level each of the recommendations at each of the facilities. And then the refineries and this task force and myself would set objectives for implementing each of the recommendations, and then we held ourselves accountable to getting that done. So obviously, we had to pace ourselves because, like I said, it's going to take multi-years, and it did. It took about 5 years to get it all pretty much implemented, but we had to make progress and we needed to get it achieved, and we needed a system to track how we're doing that and have a conversation on an ongoing basis with all the right people about that progress. So I guess the last thing on top of all that, we had the oversight by the board that wanted to know what we're able to accomplish and by when we're able to accomplish. Getting organized, I think, was our first task. Then to stay focused for such that long period of time, at the beginning, we had to deprioritize other things. And so one of the things we did is we just did not take on any commercial projects at the refinery for a period, regardless of how attractive, which was rather hard because you still had to keep people motivated that there were going to be interesting things to do, even though, you know, there weren't growth projects in the short term. But that step was absolutely necessary to get the appropriate focus on implementing the recommendations in place at pace to deliver safe and reliable operations. Because if you don't do that, the risk really, really doesn't matter.
Yeah, a lot of challenges embedded in what you just said. And I do remember the numerous discussions about how to implement the recommendations because, you know, the devil is in the detail with these sorts of things. And, you know, you had to deal with different cultures and different procedures at each of the plants, but you also were trying to instill an operating rigor that was a bit countercultural to BP, to say the least. You know, BP, you know, really valued its entrepreneurial flair. And the 80-20 principle was often a bit generously interpreted. And so you know, as BP was rewarding, you know, going on to the next new thing, you know, you really had to focus the organization on really making sure things got done. And so, you know, can you share a little bit more about getting the refineries aligned, making sure they did get done? And how important was standardization in that process?
I think your comments are spot on. The way BP operated very much was, let's keep moving, let's get to the next thing, let's make sure we're not staying still. That culture did fly a bit against what we were trying to do. as we were going forward, looking at all the recommendations, what we were essentially building was a large part of an operating management system, sort of on the fly, as you're going through this process. So we had to get everyone aligned and reach agreement, not just on the what needs to be done, but how it is going to be done. And so time and time again, we had to agree on how are we going to do that and what does done or complete actually mean? It sounds simple, but it, you know, devil's in the details. That was really hard. We held lots of full day face-to-face meetings with key refinery management, my team, myself, specifically to go through and align on the what and the how, and then where standardization made sense, we mandated, right? I'll give you an example. Our blast persistent control houses, one of the big recommendations that people needed to be safe when they operated inside a refinery. Those blast resistant control houses were all standardized to save time and to efficiently execute it across all locations. No deviations allowed, same design, same construction. That's a given. So that had to be one of the things we did. But where you didn't have to have absolute standardization, then you could allow flexibility. Part of the discussion was where standardization was required, where it wasn't required. Then I felt like one of the more critical actions that we had to take was the task force and I would visit each of the refineries on a rotating basis to ensure what we came to call the rigor in the field, make sure that was complete, to basically determine that they had met an acceptable compliance with what we had agreed.
Yeah, I think those visits are really important to making sure that cultural shift of operating rigor really was taking hold. And you mentioned that there were areas where you thought about flexibility when you came to the conclusion that that was okay. Can you give an example of where flexibility made more sense than a strict standardization process?
Sure. Every refinery, every operating plant, they have their own processes for maintenance and projects to make sure they're done safely. What we instituted sort of on top of that was a BP control of work process. So it allowed for you to use normal local procedures, but you had to have, before you started the work, you had to follow how we were going to identify the risk that you were facing, that they were evaluated prior to people initiating work. And as long as the risks were identified and mitigated, then the work was good to go. The key to our effort was ensuring that the risks were properly identified. You know, they were identified, they were assessed, proper controls put in place. So it wasn't one size fits all, but we did ensure a common approach to the methodology of risk management, and then required only the very important items to be standard.
Yeah, and I want to build on this focus of risk identification and management, especially in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon accident, which we alluded to at the beginning of this podcast. And, you know, a bit like the Texas City incident, I remember exactly where I was when I heard the news. You know, I was actually living in Shanghai at the time, and I actually saw it on CNN. And it wasn't immediately known because it was a drilling rig. It wasn't really known who it was on lease to right away. But I did know that BP had a large presence in the Gulf of Mexico deep water. But my heart just sank when actually it was confirmed that it was a BP leased operating rig. You know, many months later, you know, I was asked to come back to London and lead up the global transformation of BP safety and operating risk culture in the downstream business in the aftermath of the accident. And much like you, when you were approached about the Texas City refinery turnaround, I just felt that this was just so important that I had to take it on. And that's when we started working closer together to spread this operating risk management throughout the company, with a particular focus on the high impact, low probability events that you mentioned early, which of course are disproportionately process safety. But just to make sure everybody's on the same page, you know, risk is actually the multiplication of the probability of the event happening and the impact that what would happen if it did. And so, you know, after the Deepwater Horizon, the BP focus was really on ensuring that every corner of the corporation properly identified their risk, consistently assessed the impacts, and then identified the appropriate controls and the layers of protection that were required to mitigate these risks. And so, you know, these efforts, you know, had to actually mesh throughout the entire company. Now, so some of the challenges that you took on in the U.S. refining system now, you know, we had to mesh up with the upstream businesses, but also had to extend into every aspect of the downstream, the chemicals, the lubricants, the terminals, retail, and even to some extent, the rest of the global refining portfolio. So as I think about, you know, you're in the middle of your transformation journey for the BP U.S. refining system. Now you have this additional pressure and actually complications to some extent, whether we're talking about the independent monitor, the board, the executives, the new safety and operating risk organization. You know, would you describe that time? I mean, how did you go about dealing with that on top of where you were in your journey?
Yeah, it was a crazy time. Like you said, everybody remembers where they were when Deepwater Horizon started and then the aftermath for the next several years. You know, I always feel like more eyes on a problem is helpful, and no one knows as much, you know, as all of us know together. Yeah, there were definitely some pinch points, if you remember. We had worked it for 2+ years in U.S. refining before the Deepwater Horizon incident. And, you know, the company, you know, had made a public commitment to complete all the recommendations in the Baker Report. As you noted in your question, they even had gone out and appointed an independent monitor whose sole job was to assess the progress and to assess our performance and my performance, right? So, you know, he was a check the checker and give the board one more level of assurance that all the things in the Baker Report would be done. So anything that modified our plans or to some extent changed the course was rather uncomfortable for me and for the team and for the U.S. refining folks. So, you know, we weren't really consulted prior to the effort that was put in place, which definitely had to be done. But at the beginning, we were stepping on top of each other until we worked through it. So I think you'll agree we eventually worked through it. We got an understanding of what had been done and what you could share and kind of what would change. And in the end, we were able to incorporate the learnings across the entire company. And I believe that was really beneficial for BP that, you know, we had a head start and you could use that head start as you move forward for the rest of BP. But yeah, undoubtedly it was a difficult and bumpy time in BP. But that's what we're paid to do, I guess, as execs, figure it out, listen to the wisdom of those around you, decide on how you're going to guide an organization to implement change, and then implement change in a way, hopefully, that you're going to get it embedded in the company.
Yes, I think that's probably one of the biggest leadership challenges, because there's nothing more important than making sure that you embed the change and really get it to stick. You know, as I look back on my career, I can't remember the number of times where people talked about a site or a company or even an industry saying that they had to, quote, get back to basics. You know, and I really do hope that we learn, you know, increasingly how to embed change and reinforce it so that you don't need to keep relying on interventions to keep that vigilance up high on operating risk. So for the sake of time, I'd like to move on to your time after BP. As I mentioned earlier, you joined Sasol, the flagship South African energy company, whose roots were actually in making liquid fuels out of coal, and therefore had exposure to mining, as well as all the usual hydrocarbon, oil and gas explosion risks that we've dealt with for a number of years. So how was your experience in the BP system and the refining system? How did that inform your approach when you were at Sasol?
Yeah, like you said, there were large process operations in Sasol. For me, that was the easy part, given what we've just gone through in BP, to be able to apply the risk management issues that we've spoken about, you know, to the processes in Sasol. The different part was the risk that comes from Sasol's underground mining operations. Underground mining is a different animal. My first objective was to really understand the miner's risk, because I'm not a miner. And so breaking it down, looking at where does the risk come from, and as we've both seen in our career, the people closest to the operations generally know the risk and they know them well, but often they become comfortable living with risk, something called risk minimization. The biggest risk in the mining environment was the very close proximity of large moving equipment with multiple personnel around it in an extremely confined space. So that's what we had to focus on in Sasol. That was the highest concern and highest risk. So taking my fresh eyes view to the broader Sasol organization, identifying that risk and how to attack that risk, and trying to get them to remain kind of alive to that risk was the key. And by elevating the perception of that risk, then you can provide the energy of the organization to raise the standards and then execute against that. So that's where I spent more time in that space than on the process safe in Sasol.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges always is fighting this complacency and this very human tendency to minimize risks that we see every day. You know, as I take that on to as we sit here today and reflect on the high hazard industries around us, you know, it seems like accidents continue to occur. And perhaps more frustrating, you know, the root causes of them don't seem to change. You know, when you think about the experiences that you've lived through and our collective ability to learn from some of these painful incidents, why does it seem that we constantly have to relearn these lessons the hard way?
I really think it comes down to having a risk-averse culture, right? Some companies have it, but not many. I think because it's not easy. It's not easy to maintain rigor in the field. And in my opinion, not a lot of organizations seem to reward it appropriately. It's not sexy. It's not even interesting to a lot of people. But if you don't have a risk-averse culture and you don't have the methodology in place to assess risks, then eventually some bad things are going to happen. I wish I had an easy answer, Gene, but the learnings are out there. The Baker Report recommendations, they're still applicable every hazardous process industry. We know they work, right? What's that saying about, you know, a wise man learns from others? Well, I would think we would be wise by now. Texas City, the incident there happened almost exactly 20 years ago, March 23rd, 2005. All I can say is we've got a good The standard you can use, trying to get it embedded into a culture is really the hard part.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think, you know, executing, the roadmaps are out there, and executing and getting that operating rigor inside an organization as we reflect, as you mentioned, on the 20th anniversary of the Texas City tragedy. And in fact, that's what these podcasts are about. It's actually about reflecting, learning, and hopefully today's leaders and future leaders don't have to learn the lessons the hard way like we did. And so with that, you know, I'd really like to thank Steve for a fascinating conversation today, for his passion and his insights on keeping people safe and preventing operating accidents.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed being here. The time with BP working in this space was one of the most rewarding parts of my career. So thanks for the chat.
And I also want to thank everybody listening today and for all your efforts on becoming wise and keeping people safe. And so until next time, stay safe.
Pilco and Associates is the leading advisor to officers and boards on operational EHS and ESG risks and liabilities in the global chemical and energy industries. With 45 years of experience, the firm advises on driving rapid, dramatic, and sustainable improvements in safety, reliability, and competitiveness. Hilco's advisors have an average of 38 years of relevant professional experience in operational and executive roles with major energy and chemical companies. For more information, go to www.pilco.com.